Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And now, prepare yourself for the only talk radio show you'll want to turn up.
Crank this thing.
Sirius XM Pandora presents the place where your hard rock and metal voice can still be heard.
You bet your ass, baby.
Unfiltered, uncensored, say whatever you want.
Hit the record button. Anything can happen, you know?
I know that ain't nobody out there came to be mellow tonight, now did you? I say there ain't nobody. I'll say there ain't nobody not out there that even wants to be a little bit mellow. Now is there? Anybody wants to get mellow, you can turn around and get the fuck out of here, all right?
This is the Trunk Nation Podcast. With host Eddie Trunk.
What's up, everybody? It's Eddie Trunk, and welcome to the Eddie Trunk Podcast. New episodes every Thursday. News-making interviews with the biggest names in rock and metal. And as I tell you guys every week, all the interviews you hear on the podcast originated on my SiriusXM radio show, Trunk Nation, heard live Monday through Friday on Faction Talk, SiriusXM channel 103, or anytime on the SiriusXM app. If you're in the U.S. or Canada and you can get SiriusXM and you only listen to this podcast, you're only getting a tiny fraction of what I do on the radio on a daily basis. So come on board and join us for the show. If you can't listen in the live window of 3 to 5 Eastern, you can always listen anytime on demand on the app. And there's nightly re-airs on 103 as well at midnight Eastern. You also get a sixth show on Hair Nation on Mondays only, 5 to 8 Eastern. So six live shows a week on SiriusXM. Hope you come on board. And we'll make it easy for you right now to come on board if you're not already a SiriusXM subscriber, because I can give you 3 months for free with no credit card required. If you'd like information on signing up for that, all you got to do is go to SiriusXM.com/Eddie Trunk. Information is there. Try it out for 3 months. Join us every day on Trunk Nation. Again, no credit card required. Hope you do so. We've got two interviews for you this week. First up, John Corabi, who is back in the Dead Daisies as their lead singer. When he called into the show, he was currently on tour with his solo acoustic show opening for Tom Kiefer, which he's still doing, actually. But then he'll be going back to the Dead Daisies. They have a tour coming up with about 15 dates in America. So you can go to their website and take a look and see where if they're coming your way. And Corabi is also prominently featured in this great documentary that is now on Paramount Plus called I Wanna Rock, Live in the 80s Metal Dream. And it's a real interesting insight into John's life and career that a lot of people are talking about. And we touch on that in this interview as well. So John Corabi, of course, best known as a former singer of Motley Crue, he will be joining us to talk about his career and everything going on with him to start off on the podcast this week. Then, in the second part of the podcast, we'll bring you a second interview. And this one's a little different because it's with an NFL football team owner. And that owner is Jim Irsay, the owner of the Indianapolis Colts. Now, why would Jim Irsay be on a rock talk show? Well, Jim Irsay is a huge collector of memorabilia, including music memorabilia. And he goes around the country and presents this memorabilia in a big show for free with a charity angle to it, and also has performances tied to it. I saw it for myself in Vegas a few months ago. The interview you're about to hear was leading into Jim doing it in Boston. Since this interview was done, that event has already taken place. So keep that in mind when you hear it. This is, again, from my radio show a few weeks ago. The event is already taking place. But there's interesting stuff in here from Jim Irsay about his collection and about accumulating it and some of the music artifacts in it. And I think you're going to really enjoy it. And it's the first time and maybe only time I've ever interviewed a guy who's a billionaire. And I talked to him about helping us build a real Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, as you're about to hear. So Jim Irsay talking music and his collection, owner of the Indianapolis Colts, second, will lead with John Corabi right now on the Eddie Trunk podcast. John, how are you, buddy?
I'm good. And before I start anything, I just have to say, go Eagles. Okay, now we're ready. Okay, awesome.
I left that off intentionally on your rundown of your resume that you're also an Eagles fan. Despite that, yes, we're still fans.
I know. I figured I'd, you know, well, when your producer called, I just, I answered it like that. I thought it would be you, but he was laughing. Anyway,
but he's a Giants fan too, so you're in Giants territory right now, buddy. So you're on enemy property right now.
Exactly, I hear you.
But that's what the rivalry's all about, man. That's how it should be. You know, you should be against the other three teams in the East. I hate the other three teams in the East besides the Giants. That's what being a fan is.
Exactly. Awesome.
So how's it going out there with Kiefer?
Dude, it's been great, man. You know, honestly, I've known Tom and I have known each other for 40 plus years. We've cut our teeth in, you know, the Philadelphia, New Jersey club circuit doing covers, and you know, we've been on the road for God since beginning of June, and every now and then we get talking about, you know, the old days and all this other stuff. But it's been a blast. The fans have turning out, and the shows are, everybody's playing their butts off, so it's been cool, a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm going to see you on the 28th. I'm hosting the show you guys are doing in Houston at Rise Rooftop, and yes, that's just you. Now there's no winger on that date. That's just Tom and you. So do you play longer? I imagine.
Yeah, a little bit longer. You know, it's. You know, it's weird. I did this before with Tom, one of the last runs he did with Cinderella, and I didn't know how it was going to work, but it's been great, man. You know, so right now there's three bands on the bill, so I do like 35 minutes, and then once Winger goes off on their own, I'll probably get bumped up to like 45, 50 minutes, something like that, whatever. I'll just tell more jokes.
Well, are you up there? You're not up there with a full band, right? This is you just with the guitar, acoustic?
Yep, it's just me, as you've seen before, just me with an acoustic guitar and a few stories here and there. I'm keeping them very condensed, but it's so far so good, man. It's been awesome. Having a great time.
Speaking of stories, last time we spoke, at least on the air, was Monsters on the Mountain, and you had just released your autobiography. Now that it's been out for a little bit, and now that it's had a chance to sink in out there a little bit, how do you feel about it? How is the reaction to it from your fans? And, you know, what are your thoughts now that it's been able to be out and circulate a bit?
It's cool. You know, it's honestly, I told you before, like I wasn't really looking to do a book, you know, but then obviously the COVID thing happened and Paul Miles contacted me and he's like, well, you ready now? So we did it. Rare Bird's been great. And you know, with very supportive of the book. And, honestly, other than the fact that a few of the fans were a little discouraged at how many times I used the F bomb in the book, they said it was a great read. So, you know, it is what it is. I look at everything like, you know, even with records, I do the best that I can. I do the best vocals or write whatever, and I put it out there, and then I'm on to the next thing. You know what I mean? And whatever happens with it, it's going to happen, you know. But so far it's been great, dude. It's selling well. I brought a bunch with me and I'm almost out. So I got to call Rare Bird and get more books for the second half of the tour, but it's been cool. It's been awesome.
For people that missed the book when it originally came out, I can't recommend it more highly. It's a great read. It's insightful. It's honest. It's revealing. It's funny. So there's great stuff in there, and I think people will really enjoy it. If they did not read it, you should absolutely get Karabi's autobiography, which has been available for a while. And that's cool that you're selling them on the road so you can get out there and sign them and hand them right to the people. That's always a nice thing.
Yeah, it's been I was surprised, because, we've got everything, the T-shirts and all that stuff. But the books have been, there's been quite a line each night for the books. So it's cool. Again, it's weird not to sound pessimistic. I consider myself to be an optimistically pessimistic person. But, like I said, I did the book. I put it out there. I kept my fingers crossed and moving onward and upward. So it's all good.
So you are coming back to some familiar territory. I guess you start to engage with this when you're done with this tour with Kiefer, and that is a second tour of duty rejoining the Dead Daisies. Tell me about that decision and how that came about.
Honestly, you and I have talked before, and I told you, I when I was in the band, again, not to sound weird, but I did that first record with the band, and it just kind of blew up, and it got to the point we were doing tours with Kiss and Whitesnake, and we were going overseas and doing festivals and. So I in the period of 3 years, I think we did four albums or a little longer. It was four albums, a bunch of world tours. And I all of us, even the management, everybody was burnt. And then I had my son in my other ear, Ian, for my solo band. He's sitting there going, great, Dad, I moved to Nashville to be in the solo band with you. And, we've done nothing. what's going on? So I just kind of got off the roller coaster for a minute. The guys, they grabbed Glenn Hughes and did a couple of great records with Glenn. And, now Glenn has decided to go back and do his Deep Purple thing. And I believe he's in the studio now working on a Black Country Communion record. So they just called me up and they're like, hey, are you rested? Are you ready to go? And I was like, yeah, we sat down. I spoke with David, Lowy. We had dinner in Nashville and he basically just kind of said to me, I want to get out. I want to play. I want to tour, but I don't want to kill ourselves doing it. And I'm like, okay, awesome. That's all I needed to hear. And it, so far it's been great. We rehearsed, probably about 2 months ago. We had a week in New York and, we rehearsed for about a week and it was awesome. I got another one coming up in a few days. I'm flying back to New York to rehearse for another 4, 5, 6 days. And then, I finished the tour with Tom on August 18th at the Ryman. 19th is laundry day at my house, and I go right back out on the 20th with the Daisies. So it's cool.
Yeah, you've got tour dates that are already announced out there, a nice run. And the lineup, just to bring everybody up to speed on where the Dead Daisies are at now, and I've had every person who's been ever in this band on this show over the 10 years they've existed, including Lowy. Including the guy whose band it is, David Lowy, who did a pretty long interview with me that was very candid last year, I think it was. But right now, the band, now because Glenn played bass and sang, so you brought in Michael Devin, who I know as well, to play bass. So Glenn actually had two people replace him, you and Devin, and then the rest of the band remains the same. Doug Aldridge, Tishy, who came back a couple years ago, and, of course, Lowy and yourself. John, yes. Why do you think, by every measure, and I talked a little bit about this with Lowy too, we all, and David Lowy was very open about his story. Everybody knows his story at this point, that he's a wealthy guy and he has his fun doing this band And apparently, you know, everybody in the band travels well and is treated well, and it's a great gig, and it's a great situation. And everyone who's come on this show has said that. That being said, in the 10 years this band has existed, there's been a ton of turnover of members, including yourself now back for your second tour of duty. Why do you think that is?
Well, first of all, the list of people that have been involved in this, for example, I'll use one that you're very aware of, Damon Johnson. Damon's on the list of members of the band. Damon, though, was Yogi as well from Buck Cherry, but like those guys, there was a couple issues where David had some pressing things that he had to deal with. So we called Damon and said, "Hey, dude, what are you doing for 2 weeks?" And he's like, I'm open." You know, so we basically rehearsed with him real quick and flew him out. And he came in and he did a run until David could get back. So it's a little bit of a misleading number of people. I know Daryl Jones and Bernard Fowler are on the list. They came to Cuba with us when we did those shows. And Daryl filled in and did a few shows for Marco. But it wasn't like a long-term thing. Now, David put this band together. Initially, he had, you know, like Richard Fortus and Dizzy, and he wanted great players, but he also knew, like, guys like Richard and Dizzy may or may not at some point leave and go back to their other thing. And he's just kind of left it open and, you know, like it is what it is, you know, like it's just like, okay, well, if you got to go do something else, you know, good luck. And we're going to find somebody else, you know, and like we did with Richard, we got Doug Aldrich, you know, but really he's tried to put a core band together, but, you know, for example, now, like Marco on this run, Marco's like, you know, he's doing his thing. He's knee deep in his solo career. And, you know, so he couldn't come back. And so it is, you know, it's just, you know, at times you got to find a piece to fit in the puzzle. But it's worked out great. You know what I mean? For David, he's kept the thing running for 10 years and, you know, still moving forward. So. It is what it is. I know a lot of people don't understand it, but, you know, they use the term collective for a reason.
What is your approach going to be to singing, or will you sing material from the two records they just made with Glenn? Because I agree with you. Those are real good records. But, and we all know Glenn has, you know, pretty special voice that's can get up there and sing in a way that's pretty crazy still. Vocally, are you going to be able to do that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, we're doing a few of the Glenn songs, and there's a couple spots where it's like, okay, I'm not even going to try and hit that note, you know, so I just kind of, you know, the integrity of the song is there, and I'm just kind of bluesy in it up a little bit, and making it more my thing, you know what I mean? But for the most part, the integrity of the songs are there. We found the ones that weren't over the top, where Glenn was, you know, going crazy with, you know, he's unbelievable, dude. Like just going back and listening to this stuff, I'm like, holy God, like, how does this guy do it? But we found ones that I'm comfortable with, and they sounded pretty good. You know what I mean? So it's, you know, but I'm just kind of changing them a little bit here and there and making them my own.
Yeah. Well, that's all you can do. I mean, and obviously I love your voice and you're a great singer as well. It's just, it's a different kind of singing. It's a whole different thing that Glenn does. It's like, again, even at his age, like you said, the notes he can sing is crazy.
It was funny, though, too, because there were some things that I did with the daisies that Glenn attempted to do, and he just didn't feel comfortable with it. He's like, nah, man, I can't sing that one. You know what I mean? Right. So he picked ones that he felt comfortable with, and he sang them his way. And I did the same thing. I listened to the stuff with the guys, and I'm like, well, okay, I think I'm good with these. So let's do these, you know? So, you know, we're still blowing the dust off of some stuff. You know, but it sounded great by the end of the last, you know, round of rehearsals. By the end of the week, it sounded awesome. So now it's like, we just want to put the show back together again. And, you know, in all honesty, like David said, I just want the ringleader back. Like, you know, it was funny. He kind of likens me to, he said, when you're out there on stage, it's like you invited 1,500 or 2,000 people to a barbecue, and you're just joking with them and kidding with them and having fun. So they're like, let's put a kick-ass set together and just go out and have some fun. So we'll see what happens, man. I'm excited about it, though. It sounded great. I'm looking forward to the next batch of rehearsals. And then, you know, after driving around in my motorhome in my truck on this tour, it'll be good to get back on the jet again.
you travel a little differently when you were in the Dead Daisies, that's for sure. You guys roll
just
large.
A little, it's, yes.
It's a nice thing. The dates are August 22nd. The shows start in, I'm not sure where this is, but you're a PA guy. Maybe you know, Lititz, Pennsylvania.
It's Lititz. Out there near Lancaster, Pennsylvania. You know, and it's really okay. Funny, too, because it was like, I just recently found out it's Lititz. I was.
Yeah, you can get in trouble saying that the wrong way.
Yeah, well, that's what I was doing, because, to be honest with you, there's three little towns in a row. Lititz, Blue Ball, and Intercourse. You do the math. So, I am not kidding you. Look it up on a map.
There's no way. Three of them in a row. No way. Are you being serious?
I'm totally being serious. It's Lititz. There's like Blue Ball and Intercourse, Pennsylvania. Yes.
I thought you were making a joke.
No, I'm not making a joke. I'm serious. So for years, I was using the other pronunciation of Lititz. You do the math.
Oh, my gosh. That is insane. Well, anyway, from there you go, Jersey. For our listeners in Canada, you've got a good 4 or 5 shows in Canada, Toronto, Hamilton, Montreal, Ottawa, Vancouver. You're in Canada quite a bit. And then finishing up in L.A. With the last date at least announced now on September 10th. At the Roxy, you got a date in Vegas there at Vamped on the 9th. So everybody can go to the band's site and see the dates. There's there's about 10-15 right now, U.S. and Canada announced. And the other piece of this is, since the band is celebrating 10 years, there's a compilation record coming out, right? Like a best of record.
Yeah, and it's weird. Like it's kind of cool because the band has been together now for 10 years. But there's a lot of obviously, you know, like Glenn's got a huge following on his own. So a lot of people came into the Dead Daisies not really knowing much about the band with my time in it, or John Stevens, for example. So it's just cool. They put a best of record together. They've got some John Stevens stuff on there, some of mine, some of Glenn's. And it's just kind of like, hey, this is what we've done in the last 10 years, and hopefully there's way more to come. So, you know, I kind of dig it because there's been a few fans even that were partial to, like, my years that didn't really know. Like, when I left, they thought that, you know, whatever, and they kind of fell off the train for a minute. And I was like, oh, they've done some great stuff with Glenn Hughes. And they were like, oh, I'll have to check that out. So this is just a cool way for everybody to become familiar with everything the Daisies have done.
Last thing on the Dead Daisies, have you guys talked about a new record?
You know, a little bit. I mean, again, Eddie, like when we got together, like I hadn't played these songs in forever. And then there was a lot of stuff, too, that we're kind of doing in our set that they didn't play, even with Glenn. So, you know, right now we're just focused on putting a kick-ass set together, you know, obviously go out and promote this new record. And then, you know, we've talked about new music, you know, but right now we haven't slotted anything like, all right, we're going to do a record in January or February. But there's been some talk, but nothing concrete yet. But we'll see.
All right. Before I let you go, a few other things I want to hit you with. I mentioned this at the when I introed you as well, and I've had a chance to see this. I don't know if you even had a chance to see it yet, but there is a new three-part documentary series called I Want to Rock, Living the 80s Dream, coming to Paramount Plus on the 18th of this month. 3 one-hour episodes, and I've had a chance to watch it, and it focuses on a few different people in it and their stories, and you are one of the primary people featured in it. Have you had a chance to see it yet?
I've seen pieces of the last version I saw was they were still kind of getting like some of the sound, like you could hear like there was like background noise, and it wasn't quite sound wise edited yet, but you know what I saw, I liked, you know what I mean. It's really cool because it's not just about the thing that I like about it. It's not about the, you know, totally or 100% about the partying and the excess. You know, there's a little bit of that in there, but it really kind of delves into the each person that's involved, like why they got into music and how they got into music and, you know, and then leaving wherever they came from and going to California to chase the brass ring, you know? So it was a little bit of a different angle, and I thought it was really cool. So I was as surprised as anybody. I got a call from people and Tyler Meacham, and they said, you know, we want you involved in this. And I was like, okay. You do realize I'm the guy that ruined Motley's career, right? And so they're like, you know, they'd be laughing about it. But it's cool. I'm excited about it. And I'm really excited, too, because they're featuring a song that I wrote with Marty Fredrickson at the end. So I'm going to try. I'll send it to you when we get off the air. But it's a new song that's going to be in the documentary, and I want to try and set everything up so I can put that out as well in conjunction with or right after the premiere or the release of the, you know, the series. But I'm excited about it, you know.
I agree with you, and in full disclosure, I helped out a little bit on it behind the scenes. I'm not in it, but I helped do some consulting work behind the scenes on it. And I'll tell you, but I was not super involved at all, and I did get an advance to look at, and I loved it. And you kind of touched on one of the reasons why I loved it so much is because we've all heard the stories a billion times of how, well, if you're like us, we lived it, but people have heard the stories of the craziness of the Sunset Strip and how great the 80s were. And then, of course, the crash with Nirvana and who's returned and who hasn't and all that. That's been covered. And yeah, that is in this thing. And it's well done, that part of it. But I love the fact that they went and really honed in on not the usual suspects when they cover when shows are done like this. People like yourself. People like Janet Gardner of Vixen, who was somebody that I recommended, Snake Sabo from Skid Row, Vicky Hamilton, who managed Motley, Poison, and Guns initially and got them going. Like, these stories are really good and different stories. And I got to tell you, John, I really think, and I don't know how many people will see this because well, there's a million streaming things these days, but hopefully people do. I think this is really going to be a big boost to you because people that know you maybe for one thing or another thing or the Motley stuff or whatever they may know, but they may not, people, unless they really are your hardcore fans, may not know your entire story. And that's really laid out pretty extensively in this.
Yeah, I was surprised. Tyler, you know, who directed it, he called me up and I told him a couple stories, and he was like, he was particularly moved by one. And, you know, but, you know, it, and that, that was the beauty of the whole thing, that I was like, okay, this isn't like, you know, cause I gotta be honest, I've been offered and asked to do other things, but it really kind of, to me, it really kind of focused more on the, you know, the chicks that, you know, and I, like, I'm like, dude, it's been done. I don't want to be involved in this. And the thing that appealed to me about this was, like you said, it's the deeper story of how what I had to go through to get to LA. And the best one, I got to be honest with you while we're talking about it, because I just told Kip this. Dude, like, I think one of the most insane parts of the, I told Kip this, and I don't care what anybody thinks, but like, I was almost moved to tears to the part where Kip, who we all know his story about his, you know, his wife and the tragedies there, and then being, you know, this world famous band, and in the cartoon characters that are just taking a piss out of him every whatever. But the fact when he got that nominated for a Grammy for that you know, classical piece, and I just told him, I said, dude, I've never been happier in my life. Like, I just watching that, I was so happy for you. Do you know what I mean? Like, after seeing that. And I think it's really going to move a lot of people. There's some really deep stories there, and you know, I call it the rags to riches to, you know, rags to riches to rags story, and, you know, trying to climb back out of the hole again. So it's pretty cool. It's pretty deep, and I like the way they did it.
Yeah, and you're right. The stuff on Kip is incredible too, because it covers the, you know, the Beavis and Butthead, the rise, the fall, but also
everything.
the stuff that people may not know about Kip. Like you said, the classical music and all the success he's had doing that. I mean, I talk about it a lot, but this is a broader thing, obviously. So I think that I think it's really going to be interesting, and just, it's very candid, like Janet Gardner admitting and showing that she's a dental hygienist and left Vixen and how to get a job and what she's doing now and things like that, and Vicky's story being more behind the scenes in the industry and being there at the beginning on all these bands that went on to major status and unfortunately losing them along the way. But yeah, it's real good for people that you know, have Paramount Plus. July 18th is the, I think they're going to do one episode a week. They're three episodes, an hour long. And John Corabi is featured throughout, and really, really good. Very well done. This isn't some sort of like YouTube thing, unauthorized, whatever. This is fully involved with the artists and MTV and all of that. So there's great stuff in there. And finally, John, obviously there's a lot in that show, in that, about your time in Motley Crue. And, you know, I'm curious what you know, your take on, I mean, I know you're close with Mick. I don't even know, as far as Mick's record is concerned, there's been so many people in and out of that, and it's taken so long. At the end of the day, are you on it or not? Or do you know?
I don't know. And I have to be honest with you. Like, I texted Mick when that first press release came out, and he did not respond, which was odd for Mick.
Me too, by the way. I texted with Mick, and I did the same thing and didn't hear him, and that was odd. Hear from him.
Yeah, he was radio silent. And so it was funny. I was in Switzerland, and I texted his wife, Serena, and I'm like, oh, I'm in your motherland, blah, blah, blah. And she immediately texted me back and said, oh, you know, I can't wait to go there at Christmas or whatever it was. And then I wrote, how's Mick? Radio silence. And I'm like, okay. And then I got asked at a book signing in London. They said a fan, because there was fans there, and the fan said, hey, what do you think of this whole Motley Crue thing? You know, the release that was put out. And I said, well, from experience, that release was put out by Motley Crue and their management. I'm not saying a word. I don't believe a word of it, but I'm not saying a word until I hear from Mick. And then obviously we know what happened there. You know, but mixed record, I don't know if I'm on it or not. I think that there's going to be, between me, you, and the fence post, I don't know if the record will come out, because unfortunately, I believe, I could be wrong on this, but I think Mick, his record, when he was finished, he signed a record deal with Alan Kovac's record label.
Motley's label and management. I know, I've talked about that too. I was,
yes,
because Jacob now, Bunton worked on the record too, and I think Jacob had told me that.
Yes, and so I gotta believe that
it's going to be tied up.
They're not going to allow him to release that record, because if he generate, I know how those guys work, and it's like if he releases this record and makes, you know, any money at all, it's going to go to a lawyer to help him with his lawsuit. So they're probably going to sit on that record. And I just hope that Mick can get it back, get it out. And I hope that he's got his ducks in order, you know, and got all his facts correct, so that he doesn't sit there with egg on his face at the end of this. You know, but we'll see. You know, I'm as clueless as everybody else is. You know, and it to me, you know, as much as I've been through with the guys, to me, the whole thing is just sad. They've got a 41 year legacy, and it's kind of like peeling an onion. Like, it's just coming. Like, it's not good. You know what I mean? This whole thing is not good. So,
you know what I think about? If they would have adhered to their contract when they ended, that they were never going to come back, none of this would be happening. But
well,
of course,
and you know something, I gotta be honest with you. Like, my wife, I remember when I was in Rat, one of the last tours I did with him, we did some shows with the Scorpions in like Illinois in the Midwest. And my wife was a huge Scorpions fan. And she was like, oh my God, I'm never going to get to see them again. So I flew her up. She came to the show, and I got her like sitting on a chair, like right on the side of the stage, and she was just in her glory. And then it was like, well, we've kind of decided that we're going to keep going. And I mean, I nothing against the Scorpions. I don't care what anybody chooses to do, but it's, my wife was like, how did these bands get away with telling everybody they're going to retire? They charge astronomical sums of money for the retirement tickets, and then they don't retire. Like, so, and my wife now is at a point, as much as she loves the Scorpions, she will never buy another Scorpions record again, because she feels like she was frauded. And, you know, when Motley signed that agreement, I just looked at my wife and I go, I think we're about to have another Scorpions episode. You know,
yeah,
what I mean?
I talk about it all the time. I don't know how anybody can ever believe, not just Motley, the Eagles just announced their farewell, and they said they're going to play for as long as they want to, and play in as many many nights and in consecutive nights in cities until the tickets are all exhausted, and they'll probably go into 25 or 2026. And they announced their first farewell in like 2002. So it's like, it's a running joke. Yeah. I mean, there's no band that's ever done it and stayed away. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah,
anybody buys into
you know,
it.
It's, you know, I mean, and again, to each his own, you know, but it's like, when did Ozzy announce the No More Tours tour?
92.
Yeah, and, you know, I love the guys in Kiss, but I think they've been on a farewell tour since, like, what?
23 years?
Yeah, you know what I mean? So, who knows, dude? I don't.
The Who in 82, John, the Who announced their farewell in 82, 41 years ago. They're still playing shows.
Yeah, so.
I just read this. Wait a minute. One more for you. I just read this last night. I forgot to mention this. Elton John. The long goodbye, Yellow Brick Road, whatever he was calling it, farewell tour, played the final show the other night. At the end of the show of what was billed as his final show, he stepped up to the microphone. He said, I'll be back way sooner than you think. Imagine if you drop like 20 grand on a ticket thinking you're seeing the final ever Elton John show, and then you walk out of the place saying, what? It's insane. Like,
come on. You know what I mean? And it's just, it's funny to me, you know, again, to each his own, you know, maybe there's a master plan that I haven't figured out yet. But I'm here to tell you today, I'm retiring until tomorrow. Like, whatever.
Hey,
if it works for everybody else, it's got to work for me, dude. Come on.
Yeah, why not? One other thing that just hit me, I often forget that you were in Rat. And I just had Piercy on my show the other day, and we were talking. And, you know, they put out this box set of all the Rats, the classic Rat stuff. But what is your take on that? Because that's a band that so many people ask me about, and you were in there for a little while, that you know, really could be doing some stuff right now, could possibly be like third billed on a stadium tour or headlining some of these 80s themed things. And they just cannot make that thing work. The different dynamics and history of lawsuits and all of that. Do you have any insights on what really goes on, having been somebody on the inside of Rat, as to why they can't function?
I love Warren, Bobby, Juan, even Carlos, Robbie Crane, like everybody that's been involved in things, Jizzy, you know, Steven. But it's crazy, dude. Like, we used to laugh. Robbie Crane will tell you too, but like me, Robbie Crane, and like Craig Bradford, who's actually tour managing Tom Kiefer right now.
Yeah.
We would go out, we would show up at rehearsal, and they would say, oh, yeah, rehearsal at 12. And we'd get in there and we'd start setting our gear up. And then Bobby and Warren would start going at it about the tempos of the song. And it would just go on and on. So I'd be sitting there with my guitar on and Crane sitting there. And then Crane would go, hey, dude, you want to go get a sandwich? I'm like, yep, okay. And we'd literally go get a sandwich, eat the sandwich at Subway or wherever we went, come back, and they'd still be arguing about the same song. And it's just, it's crazy to me. I love all those guys individually, but when you put them all together, they're all like, it's like this toxic, I don't know what it is. Like, they cannot function together. And I just saw Blotzer at Troy Patrick's wedding a couple years ago, and I'm like, dude, Motley's figured it out. They just travel separately. Like, just do what you got to do. Like, put the band back together again. Get out there. Like you said, I mean, I could have easily seen Rat on that, you know, Motley, Def Leppard, Poison, Rat tour. It could have been awesome. But they can't get out of their own way. I love those guys individually. Steven and I are fine. Like, he always texts me for my birthday or Father's Day or whatever. And, you know, but it's crazy when you put them all together, you put all the ingredients in the pot, it's supposed to be a really tasteful stew. For some reason, it's like, nah, dude, it's onion soup and they forgot the onions. It's weird.
Yeah. I know, it's hard to figure. It really is, because there's so many great songs and they could be doing some great business, but they just cannot figure it out and get out of their own way. It's great. I love them all as well. I know them all individually. I've interviewed them all in various configurations, but it's head scratching that they just, you know, it's a revolving thing as far as who has the issue with who on any given day, and they just cannot make it work.
Rat's like inviting your blind friend to a gun range. It's like, no, this ain't going to work.
Well, listen, man, I appreciate the time. Say hi to everybody out there on the road. I'll see you in a couple weeks in Houston at Rise Rooftop. Looking forward to hosting that one. And that's with you and Tom and, of course, Winger on most of the dates as well. I think L.A. Guns comes in on a few dates here and there. I think even Piercy comes out on a couple shows, if I'm not mistaken.
I think Tom and Piercy just played yesterday in Big Flats, New York. I split and went and did a couple of solo shows. They played yesterday, and I'm not sure if there's any more. But, yeah, when we get back to Nashville, I got a little break after the Daisy's rehearsals. And then it's me and Tom, and then we go to Green Bay, and Winger jumps on for, like, a show or two. And then it's me and Tom, and then Winger does the last show at the Ryman in Nashville.
Nice. All right, well, yep. Lot going on, man. John's back in the Dead Daisies. Tour dates coming up with them. The Greatest Hits record coming up with them. See John out now, like we just talked about, opening for Tom Kiefer, and see John in the coming Paramount Plus documentary called I Want to Rock, which starts on July 18th. And all good stuff, man. Good to see you're so busy, and I'll see you in Houston soon.
Awesome, buddy. You forgot to mention that I got I'm now the night manager at the 7-Eleven too. So it's all good. But I will looking forward to seeing you in Texas, buddy.
All right, man. Take care. Travel safe.
I'm in late.
Well, thanks to John Corabi. And again, check out the documentary. Check out the Dead Daisies on tour. And there may even be a few remaining dates that he has with Kiefer out there. I'm going to be hosting one, as a matter of fact, tomorrow, if you're listening to this on post day, at Rise Rooftop in Houston, which is Kiefer and Corabi. So hope to see you guys in Houston if you happen to be in that part of the country.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
Who doesn't love a classic chocolate chip cookie? Famous Amos has been making them since the 70s, 1975 to be exact. With semi-sweet chocolate chips and a satisfying crunch, it's everything classic in one bite-sized cookie. And fans couldn't get enough. That's right. You'll find our original recipe, the one you know and love, in every bag of Famous Amos original chocolate chip cookies. Find Famous Amos anywhere you buy your favorite snacks.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
All right, as I promised, a little bit of a different second interview for you this week, because it's with an NFL owner, Jim Irsay, owner of the Colts, talking about his music, memorabilia, and more. Enjoy. Jim, how are you? Thank you for the time.
I mean, of course, you could do it for a half a century. You have a wife, two kids, and a cat, and they're going to demand for you to keep going and pushing forward.
Jim, are you there?
I'm here.
You sound a little off the phone. Can you get up on the phone a little bit? Because we can't hear you so well.
Let me try this, because I went to a landline, so hold on.
How about this? Is this any
way better? Way
oh,
better.
Cool. Well,
thank
I said you can go 50 years. You got a wife, two kids, and a cat, and they're going to demand you to keep going out there on the treadmill. I mean,
you never. Well, you can't stop. And look, as somebody who's extraordinarily successful, you can speak to this. I think the minute you stop, you kind of really get complacent and lazy. You got to stay in it, right?
Well, like Waters said on Money, I think I'll buy me a football team. It keeps going on, you know.
If I could buy any football team, with all respect to your Colts, I'm a huge, huge Giants fan, but I don't think Mr. Mara is interested in selling. But if you can
put
a word in.
I love the history of the Giants, and we have our great championship game that made modern football happen in 58 and 59. With Johnny U and Weeb Eubank and all your great players. And that's where it all started. We plugged in with CBS, and the rest is history. So, great, great love for the Giants and the Meritish family there for sure. So,
I actually saw my team. I was actually at your stadium. The only Super Bowl I ever went to in my life was when the Giants beat the Patriots in Indianapolis. It's the only time I was there.
I know it. Well, we got a lot of Boston people on the line, so be careful, Eddie. You don't want to.
That's right. We're promoting a Boston event. You just reminded me.
I know. But you know what? We're going to do a Colts-Patriots rivalry just for fun off the field, breaking bread of a piece together. And Vince Woolfolk will be there, and Edgerrin James, and Tarik Glenn, and who knows who might show up. But we're going to be throwing out some footballs. You saw how we do that in Vegas. And
yeah.
So they got to be careful out there. Someone got hurt in Vegas because we told them, hey, be careful. Here comes a real NFL football. So Edgerrin, he went about 50 yards, and it ended up okay, but we had a little broken arm there from a little laddie, but he was okay, thank God. So, we're so excited. You know, I'm so glad someone who appreciates like you has had a chance to just, you know, peruse and really dig into
The
collection. You know, I'm sure you are center mostly on rock and roll guitars, et cetera, pianos, but you know, there's nothing like it in the world, you know, Eddie, and I think, you know, because you've been there, you know, when you've been to a show and you see actually what's there, even beyond, you know, music and you know, the original copy of the big book, a manuscript, the 12 Steps from 1939, the original manuscript, and Jack Kerouac's manuscript, and Secretariat Saddle, and you know, the belt from, you know, Ali won from Foreman and Zaire in 74 and the Rope-A-Dope. I mean, you know, so much is there. And the music is so great once we take it to the stage. And what other time do you have a situation where, you know, David Gilmour's Black Strat ends up in Kenny Wayne Shepherd's hands and we do Comfortably Numb and Kenny.
It's amazing.
Those solos. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's amazing, Jim, and that's what I wanted to tell my audience. You know, after I went to the Vegas event, I had a chance to meet you very briefly there, but I was there the whole day, and I watched you guys play, and we should explain to people what this is, because when you do these, you really do them in an amazing way, and amazingly, it's totally free, but you start with a great jam of world-class musicians, and I know the one you're doing in Boston this weekend is you just added Peter Wolf of Jay Giles, obviously local heroes there in the Boston area as well. And you've got Kenny Wayne Shepherd, who's phenomenal. And also you got a friend of mine who did the Vegas one, and I know is doing this one as well, Kevin Cronin from REO. I think in Vegas you had Billy Gibbons come out. So you kind of have a rotating
group
of people,
right? Well, Vince Gill will be there too for this one. And, you know, if he's not the best musician on the planet, he's certainly up there with them as a guitar player and singer. You know, just incredible, you know, to have Vince there. I've been talking to Peter Wolf. He's so excited. You know, he was kind of writing his memoirs and he hadn't played for about a year. But Mike Wanchek, our musical director, kind of our Chuck Lavelle, who's Mellencamp's, you know, 40-year-plus guy for his band. It's really great. It's going to be an incredible show, and you know, like you said, until you go, you really don't even realize what's there. And the musical performance, you know, producing this, you know, I just try to give the people what they want, and the goal is to, you know, to give them 2.5 hours of some of the greatest music around that connects possibly where we're at. You know, certainly, you know, when Kenny Wayne Shepherd got Tiger for the first time on stage and did West L.A. Fade Away in San Francisco, that was really cool and fit right into where we were in Frisco for that show. So it's incredible that way, and it's really been, you know, we've had so many, you know, the band is centric with a lot of great players, the best drummer in the world, probably Kenny Aronoff and Mike Mills from REM and Michael Ramos on keyboards. And Kenny Wayne Shepherd is like having Michael Jordan in your band. You know, he's so incredible. And Tom Bukovic, the best studio guitarist in Nashville, and so it's remarkable. It's
and Danny, you're up there, and Jim, we should tell people you're up there. When I was there, you were up there hanging out, doing a little singing, a little playing. You're part of it too, as far as the music is concerned, right?
Yeah, you know, we do about 28 songs, and, you know, I'll go up from probably like, you know, maybe four or five. You know, the biggest thing is to make the show, you know, really happen great, and you know, I do a great version of Johnny Cash's Her Trent Reznor song, which is really personal to me, and, you know, does the water vocals on Comfortably Numb, and then we blend in Gilmore's vocals with Mike Mills and Carmela Ramsey. So we get it covered. I think, you know, we're trying to work up a surprise with Vince Gill coming in, because he can sing anything so with his range. It's going to be a really exciting show, and we're going to have, like I said, it's going to be fun to have a little Colts Patriots theme and incredible night. You know, we're dealing with the Ted Williams tunnel shutdown in Boston, which is a little difficult, Eddie, but we're gonna, you know, I don't know, we may have to bring in some helicopters. No, just kidding.
Well, I mean, people might expect that from you, Jim. They might say, oh, Jim's got the resources, call in the choppers. But yeah, hopefully that gets figured out. Let me ask you about some of the key items in this, really what's a traveling museum, and the way it's displayed is so impressive. But I'm curious, you know, for you as a kid growing up, were you always a collector? Was it always like, were you somebody that collected, I don't know, baseball cards or any sort of memorabilia? Where did you kind of get that bug to start accumulating things like this?
Well, exactly, Eddie. You hit it on the head. You know, when I was 7, 8, 9 years old, I'd ride my bike down to the drugstore in Winnetka, Illinois, and they had those little mom-and-pop drugstores, you know, where they had everything, baseball cards. So, you know, I'd save up my money. I'd actually deal hot dog gum in school and, you know, buy it for 5 cents and sell it for 50 cents. So I was already a capitalist on the move, illegally in school, selling illegal contraband hot dog gum at age 8 to pay for my baseball cards. Yeah, I loved baseball cards. I had a tremendous collection, and was just, you know, went to a lot of museums in Chicago early on, and I was always fascinated with collectibles, you know, the power that they have, and you know, there's so much to the collection. You know, a lot of Kennedy stuff coming, you know, into Boston and everything, his rocking chair that he sat in, and you know, the coin he rubbed together during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 61, and just you know, so many things that tie you know, to America in the 20th century, which was an incredible century. But it also goes back, you know, we have a copy of the Declaration of Independence, one of the very few copies that was made 230 years ago by a guy named Stone. And, you know, I showed it to President Obama about a year ago in Martha's Vineyard, and I wanted him to sign it. I said, Mr. President, if you sign it, it'll kind of bridge, you know, the present to the past and could be healing. And he goes, you know, Jim, I'm not signing the Declaration of Independence. And I'm like, but Mr. President, Jim, did you hear me? Yes, Mr. President. So I'll give you a side letter. You know, when the president says no, it's no. So
Right.
So it's really cool, Eddie, all the different stuff. But I, like you, am such a huge you know, rock and roll fan, and grew up with, you know, NFL football, well, all football, you know, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and rock and roll, you know, and like, you know, Stephen Stills, I was just with him. He's going to have his 79th birthday on January 3rd, and he's doing great, and he's been a longtime friend, and, you know, he's played in a few of the shows recently, you know, John Fogerty.
Yeah, he was in Vegas.
Yeah, he was.
I saw him, yeah.
And so, you know, we've had, you know, we're going to do Farm Aid, and I think Ann Wilson from Heart's going to rejoin us, because she tries to get with us as much as we can. And, you know, we give the people what we want. You know, I was with Ann, or people said, well, she won't do Stairway to Heaven like the Kennedy Center. She doesn't like doing it. So don't even ask her. And I said, well, hey, Ann, will you do Stairway to Heaven? Oh, sure, I'll do it. You know, so we did that in Indy at the big, you know, when we sold out Lucas Oil Stadium, 50,000-plus people. And so that was incredible. You know, we've just had some incredible performances out there. And we aim towards rock and roll. You know, I brought in Natalie Merchant to New York with the New York Symphony for our show to perform with the band, and you know, it was a bit too quiet with the strings and her sensitive tones and her lyrics, and she kind of was a little bummed out people weren't listening more. And I said, well, Natalie, you know, this is rock and roll, so we kind of learned a lesson, just play loud. Yeah. You know, so yeah. we kind of chuck out the ballads, we'll do a few, but you know, we like to play a lot of rock and roll, that's for sure.
Let me ask you, if I can, with the time that we have, I'm curious about a few things in your collection. And again, you can, people who want to see more on this and learn more about this, if you go to jimursaycollection.com, there's a ton of stuff there for you to see, everything from photos to information about the event and all of that. But I'm curious, and I mean, this is probably a question that you get asked a lot, but in terms of the music portion of the memorabilia you've collected, what did you spend the most? What is the most expensive item in there? What did you pay the most for?
Well, you know, what's worth the most now, you know, I was offered by a Middle East element, kind of like the what's been going on in golf a little bit, to, you know, $1.150 billion for the collection, and they wanted to move it to Dubai, and they wanted it in totality because, you know, I put this together for 25 years with blood, sweat, and tears, and so much the collective of this collection is so incredible because there's none like it, and you can't get, you know, certain things anymore. You can't get Tiger anymore. You can't get, you know, David Gilmour's Strat. You can't get the Beatles drum kit. It's just not out there, you know. But the highest thing that was bought, like at auction, was actually Ali's belt that he beat Foreman and Zaire in '74 in the famous Roper, you know, Roper Doper in Zaire, Africa. And so that was, you know, that went for almost $7 million. You know, guitars keep breaking records. When Gilmour's Black Strat went for $4 million in 66 nations, we're tuned into that, you know, auction that, you know, when Gilmour's guitar went for more than a little more than $4 million, that had broken the record. And then a second Cobain from Unplugged guitar was sold to this Australian for $6 million, which made no sense, actually. It kind of, you know, broke the standards of what usually you expect them to be worth. So everything just keeps going, you know, really up in value because some of it's been owned for more than 20 years, including the scroll, you know, which was gotten in the year 2000, Jack Kerouac's On the Road scroll. So, there, you know, that's probably my favorite. You know, we've added Secretariat Saddle, which was a huge, huge addition. And that was seen out at the Belmont on Fox Sports before the race, and so it's really incredible. You know, just you know, Dylan's, probably my favorite guitar is Dylan's Black Strat that he plugged in at Newport Folk Festival in '65 when Pete Seeger threatened to cut the wires because he's supposed to be a folk singer, and right. You know, you can hear the recording. You know, Dylan's just like, you know, they're calling him a Judas. And he just says, play real fucking loud. And he broke into like a Rolling Stone. And that changed music. Then came the Birds and Revolver and Rubber Soul and all the different sorts of folk rock that emerged because of Dylan plugging in 65. So that guitar is really, really one of the most important musical instruments in rock and roll history.
You know, Jim, I was amazed. The story of you getting the David Gilmour, the Black Strat, the Gilmour Strat from Comfortably Numb, that made a lot of news. And I got to be honest with you, I was shocked that it went that it went for what it went for. You were, if I'm not mistaken, did you pay $4.4 million for that?
Yeah, it's right there with additional fees from tax and the auction charge. So that's accurate, right around $4.4 million.
Were you shocked that it went that high?
I was. You know, it was expected to go for probably, you know, and you know, 2.5, 2.3, 2.5, maybe 2.7. So that was a shocker. You know, we were, you know, down to two people bidding, me and someone else, and the other person finally dropped out. But that was an intense auction, just because, again, 66 nations involved. But again, with Pink Floyd, you have to remember, you know, international, you know, the dark yeah. side of the mood triangle, you can find that, you know, in a cab somewhere, you know, in the deep parts of, you know, Pakistan or something, anywhere, you know, it's just so iconic. So, you know, I really aim at the best of the best. Sometimes it's a big pursuit, blood, sweat, and tears and effort. You know, I went to England. I went to London to this castle. We were playing the Jaguars in 2016. And John Lennon's first cousin, Mimi's son, and John was raised by Mimi because his mom got hit by a bus when he was 9 and his dad left home. So Mimi's son was there with his wife, and he had one of John's main guitars from the Beatle era that I bought from him in a side purchase that wasn't an auction. So you pursue these things sometimes away from, you know, auction sites if you have an opportunity to get them. That was one where it was a special situation because John's first cousin telling stories about him and growing up with him, and then having the guitar there in London at this castle was incredible. So you have great memories like that as well in the last, you know, 25 years of putting this whole thing together.
You know, there's a couple items I want to, I know, you know, I don't have a ton of time here with you, but there's a couple items I'm really curious about their origins and how you got them. One thing that blew my mind, speaking of the Beatles, is you have the actual studio lyric sheet that Paul McCartney wrote the lyrics for Hey Jude. Was that just an auction thing, or is that something that McCartney himself is selling? How does that work? How does that land in your lap?
Well, I know Paul. I've met Paul. I don't know him well. In 89, I spent, you know, Valentine's Day with him and Linda before their show in Indy. And it was great, you know, spending about an hour with them and Linda at soundcheck. But, you know, really, lyrics, that was an auction item. And you debate lyrics versus guitars, for instance, because guitars, like, these guitars are great guitars as they stand alone as a guitar. Then you add the lineage who played them, and then, of course, everything changes with the history of that. But lyrics, you know, are you know, something that certainly I've been on and have some incredible. I have all of Jim Morrison's writings from Paris that were never released the 2 months before his death, you know, handwritten by him, including his microphone for all his Doors, you know, performances. Because, I mean, there's just so many things that are in the collection. It runs so deep. Like I said, not just in music, but in just pop culture and politics and history. It's been put together that way to simply say, I mean, you have to remember, we have John Lennon's piano that was in his flat for 20 years that he wrote Sgt. Pepper on, that he wrote all those great A Day in the Life, all these great Beatles songs on, a plaque he put on it. And that, to me, may be one of the most valuable pieces I have. I mean, it was his piano. We have Elton John's piano, which is so major, maybe the most important piano in the world. You know, Freddie Mercury played it at Live Aid. Paul McCartney did Let It Be in front of 2 billion people at Live Aid. You know, Elton John and John Lennon's last living performance in 74 at Madison Square Garden was on that piano with Elton John. Elton played it at all his big shows at Dodger Stadium in 74. So that piano is just incredible. It started as a white piano, then Elton painted it back black, and then decided to sell it because he got a sponsorship deal from a different piano company. So we were lucky enough to get this piano, but there can't be two pianos, any pianos anywhere except, you know, maybe the Layla piano in Georgia. That's iconic, no question. But I would say those three are the, you know, we have two of the three of the biggest pianos that come to mind in rock history.
Yeah, the other thing that gets a lot of attention that I think is a more recent addition and certainly a newer by comparison, I mean, a lot of your collection is obviously the iconic people, the founders of music, you know, of rock music, whether it's Hendrix or Dylan or all these different McCartney, the Beatles, all that stuff that you have. But you have, you acquired the Kurt Cobain guitar that he played in the Smells Like Teen Spirit video. And yeah. If I'm not mistaken, was that the most you paid for a guitar? Tell me the backstory.
That was second only to Gilmore's Black's Strat for all the, you know, Keith Floyd songs that he bought in 69 in New York City at a famous music shop. And so really it's something where, you know, Darren Julian of Julian's Auction House came and we had a press conference together and I started off the bidding at 2.2 and then I wasn't sure I was going to go for it. I was in Hawaii and the time difference was happening and this was a strange auction where they're still bidding at 3, 4 in the morning. So I just, you know, kind of, you know, called the main 48 states, so to speak, and changed my strategy and said, you know, we are going to go after this guitar, and I know what it's worth. You know, I put a number out there, which was about $100,000 more than it ended up going for, and we got it. So that was one of his main key guitars, and that means a lot, particularly with Kick the Stigma, you know, our main charity for my family and the Colts and myself and my daughter Caitlin runs it is, you know, destigmatizing mental health diseases, right, like addiction and alcoholism with Kurt everything, bipolar, anorexia, depression. So, but I think you cannot forget, Eddie, that the only Beatles drum kit in the world that was put together by buying Drumskin 2 first for almost $3 million, waiting 6 months, 6 weeks later for Ringo to sell the only Beatles drum kit in the world. And so luckily I got them both. And my friend, God rest his soul, because he was a great American, Paul Allen, the co-Microsoft founder and the, you know, $100 billion worth or wherever the stock market is worth is. I said, Paul, at an owner's meetings while I was still alive, he said, well, thanks for not bidding on Ringo's drums. I really needed that to finally put the Beatles together. He said, what do you mean? I was bidding you. I'll bid me. You know, and I said, I did. Well, thanks for not flexing your muscles then, because I wouldn't have stood a chance if he got angry. But he was always that type of guy. He respected the market. And, you know, you have to remember that was putting the Beatles back together. There is no drum kit in the world that exists that's the Beatles drum kit except that one. That is actually the only Beatles drum kit in the world. And it took, you know, a lot of effort to put together because Ringo never had one of the six surviving drop T drum skins that were made. But he had the drums. So someone else had the drum skin, and it was a famous one from all the Ed Sullivan shows and the Beatle performances, you know, that goes onto the drum head that has the drop T. And so that was put on Ringo's set like it was originally meant to be to complete the beat. And I said, you know, we got the Beatles back together finally. You know, it took a while, and yes, in an abstract way, but they're back together.
Yeah, no, and that drum set is an amazing piece. When you walk through the exhibit, it's sitting right there housed in glass, and it's just incredible. It's an incredible centerpiece to this. The stuff is endless. It's amazing. Again, you can go to JimIrsayCollection.com. You can see some of the photos of this stuff. Well, after I came back from the Vegas event, I raved about the whole event, Jim, the way your people and your staff run it, the fact that it's free for everybody to go to. You can spend, it's a wonderful day. You can walk around, look at everything. And then, of course, there's the jam. And for folks in Boston, the next one is coming up again this Saturday, starting at 6 p.m., bunch of different musical guests as well. at the TD Garden Arena. Jim, two quick questions for you. I know I don't have much more time with you.
No problem.
I'm curious, of all the stuff that you've accumulated for this collection, what has appreciated the most? What is worth more now than what you paid for it? What's gone up the most?
Well, that's a good question. You know, it's, of course, on these things, it's in, you know, the eye of the beholder and the, you know, the purchaser who is in pursuit of something when you're selling something. And it's debatable. You know, personally, I feel that the manuscript to Alcoholics Anonymous, written by Bill Wilson, Dr. Bob, you know, back then Dr. Silkworth, who was trying to find a solution, saved hundreds and hundreds of millions of lives. That's used in, you know, everything, not just drugs and alcohol, but weight loss and spiritual growth. That, you know, this was completed, you know, it was founded in 1935, June 10th in Akron, Ohio, when Dr. Bob and Bill met. Then it was written in 39, and with the help of Rockefeller, it was finally published and books were made and we were off. Everything was off forward. And now, you know, right now in, you know, 250 different countries, there's, you know, meetings going on right now as we speak on the hour, you know. And there's really nothing like it. It was ruled by historians and academic people that not Salk's vaccine for polio, not landing on the moon, but the 12 steps and the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous with the 12 steps was the greatest discovery of the 20th century. And that's really saying something, because we did some incredible things in the 20th century. So I think that's priceless. You know, I can't put a number on that. You know, certainly, God, the scroll's gone up, oh my God, so much. I mean, it's hard to say if that's worth $50 million now or whatever.
What about a music item? What about a guitar or drums? Like, in other words, you pay 4.4 for the Gilmore Strat. Since you've had that, has somebody come to you and said, hey, Jim, I'll give you $5 or $6 million for it? I mean, do you get stuff like that happen all the time? I want that Cobain guitar. I'm going to give you double what you paid. Do you field a lot of that?
Yes. I mean, we've had offers by, you know, private situations. For instance, you know, there is a Gibson SG that was owned by George Harrison, played by George Harrison and John Lennon on the White Album and other albums. It was a guitar George walked out in his hand in Candlestick Park for the last Beatles performance out of a Brinks truck in 1966. You know, George gave this to Peter Hamm of Badfinger, who committed suicide and left it to his brother, which eventually went up for auction. You know, this guitar, we've had offers north of $10 million for it in a private purchase. There's entities out there that, you know, are in pursuit of these things, some out of the country, some not here. But one thing is clear. You know, we don't sell anything, and we're never going to sell anything. Like I said, you know, the offer of $1 billion plus another $150 million, you know, for charities and public relation connections to the sale, you know, from a Middle East component, you know, that being turned down just goes to kind of show you, I think, you know, the power of the whole collection together, you know, is greater than picking it apart. You know, that can always be debated, because some people pick these things apart and think if they're selling, there's more value that way. But really, you know, Eddie, I mean, I'm not a seller. I mean, let me just say this. The collection is only 70, 75% done, you know, maybe 65% done. I mean, what you're going to see, I'm 64, if I'm blessed enough to live, you know, to 84 or a little beyond, you know, in the next 20 plus years, you know, every week, we just bought a copy of Al Pacino's notes on Scarface on a movie script, you know.
Oh, wow.
That was just added to the collection. You know, there's just, it's so immense with so many things that I can't, you know, we bought all of the KGB's secretive, you know, spy materials, the ties that can shoot a bullet, the pens that have poison. Obviously, that's been removed. But the spy museum in, you know, New York City during COVID went bust, and so I bought the museum. So we acquired all these items. So it's really that eclectic, you know, letters from Charles Manson from prison, which really gets right up to the line on what you're willing to have. But still, the Tate murders in 69 and what was happening with the country has historic importance. And even though his babble is so frightening and so schizophrenic, that it's still part of history. That's how eclectic the collection is. It's really, really unusual, and there can never be one like it. And one thing's for sure, Eddie, it's the greatest guitar collection in the world. You know,
there's no doubt.
There's not one that competes with it.
People line up just to look at. I mean, I saw it for myself. It's a wall of guitars. It's behind, you know, it's obviously sealed off, but there's stanchions, and people are just lined up waiting to get their chance to stand in front of this wall and take in this amazing collection that you have accumulated. Jim, the counter thing to what I just said is, I'm curious, what's the one that you wanted the most that got away? Was there something you wanted so badly and you got outbid on and you lost and, like, you know, you were heartbroken? The one thing you wanted so badly that you didn't get?
Yes, Eddie, it was the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous original manuscript, the 12 Steps from 39. I got outbid on that about 9 years ago. And I said, never again. If it ever becomes up for auction, you know, no matter what, I will get that item. And somehow, some way, the individual needed the money, I think, had to sell. So when it came up again, about 6 years ago, 7 years ago, I got it. I mean, it was like, I got it, you know. And so it just, you know, that was a good story because, you know, it's kind of like the love of your life that got away in high school, but you meet, you know, at work when you're age 30 and, you know, you fall in love and you get married. So, I mean, that was like a good ending story because really you have to lose sometimes. You know, I respect the market, as did Paul Allen, as did people like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Chris Martin V from Martin Guitars. I mean, you know, people go into this thing and they step away. You know, they respect the market. And you know, very few people know the market. Like, I can tell you what a guitar is worth. For instance, originally Kurt Cobain's Unplugged guitar was owned by the son-in-law or the ex-son-in-law of Kurt's and was given to him at their wedding, which was kind of controversial when his daughter got married. But he owned the guitar. And I said, look at man, I'll give you, this is worth probably, you know, about like, you know, I think about $1.4 million at the time. That's what it was worth, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. And he said, no, you know, I'm going to take it to auction. I think I can do better. I said, well, if you go to auction, I'm not bidding. I just want to let you know I'm not threatening. I'm just being honest with you. Like, you know, I think it's worth this, and I'm out in an auction. So he took it to auction, and an Australian billionaire just had to have it. And someone else just had to have it because this ridiculous auction, you know, when the most expensive guitar was somewhere around, you know, because it kept switching off. And at one time, a Beatles guitar at about, you know, $2.7 million held the record before Gilmore. And this was before Gilmore's Blackie, you know, that it went for $6 million. I mean, it just, It just we all scratched our head and said, that's just one that doesn't, it has to be taken away from the charts because it didn't make any sense. Because the market's really interesting. It started really about, 25, 30 years ago, and I've been in it from the beginning. And so, like on one Lennon guitar, I got, I said, this is my max bid, and it went for exactly that. Because sometimes what you do is say, okay, my max bid's $3 million. So you put it in, but that doesn't mean you pay $3 million. And a kind of auction like that is if it goes to $2 million, and you're right, waiting at $3 million, then you get the $2 million bid, which was the highest one. So there's other auctions. Like I was in New York City for, on the road Kerouac and all these countries. It was so big in New York, Christie's. I had never done this before, and I was there, and I admit I was liquored up. I mean, I got to confess, this is before I got sober. So I was talking to, Hunter S. Thompson and Cameron Crowe, and they said, you got to have it. So I went in there, Bill Belichick blitzing on defense every play. It's like before the guy could even put a number up, I put my paddle up. I mean, I was like, and I think everyone just said, who is that crazed guy, just forget him. He's out of his mind. Like that would, if that would have went to $25 million, I would have got for that. I was like, I don't care.
Possibly
no one is outbidding me today. Oh, by the way, pass the cognac. It just, as James McMurtry says, whiskey don't make liars. It just makes fools. But it was a good foolish endeavor because it turned out great, and I didn't know what was happening before I knew it. All these countries and reporters surrounding me, 20 people deep, and I didn't even realize it was going to be that big of a deal, So it was kind of my rookie days, as they would say. And then shortly after came Tiger, but I wasn't at that auction. I haven't been to an auction for a while, but for like Gilmore's Blackie, like I was on the phone slugging it out. The CEO of the collections, Larry Hall, does a great job, and he's at a lot of these auctions. And so it's very interesting because it only takes two to tango. When you get two competitive bidders, that's when you'll get a number high,
Oh, yeah. I do a lot of auctioning things off for charity at public events. Like I'll be on stage and I'll have a signed guitar. I host a lot of rock festivals. I'll be on the stage and we raise money for charity. And that's exactly what I noticed. It's like, I'm just working off the crowd and I'm picking people. And you start off, there's a lot of hands up. And then at the end, you hone in on those two people going back and forth and see who's going to hang in there till the end. And that's always the driver. That's where you really get your number. Jim, finally, one last thing I want to ask you. So you display this stuff brilliantly and take it on the road. Again, for folks listening in the Boston area, you're doing it at TD Garden. I saw you in Vegas. I know you do a handful of these a year. Is your plan to continue to tour this like you are, or would you like to have it in a stationary place and just build a museum somewhere and leave it instead of moving it around? Because I imagine it's a challenge with stuff this valuable to move it and display it properly and safely.
Well, you're right. It's really like Pink Floyd on the road again in the 70s, with the 300-foot pig and everything else. It's massive. It's tens of millions of dollars to this is our 10th show, but we are coming out of Boston, and we have Indy for our second show at Lucas Oil Stadium, which will be, 50,000-plus. John Mellencamp will be their hometown favorite, amongst others. And then we're going to play Farm Aid. Ann Wilson is just committed to that, and John Mellencamp's a good friend. So a lot of people want to play Farm Aid. So we're going to play Farm Aid in Indy, October. And so then we're going to go to Europe at some point, maybe 2025. And it's big over in Europe. I mean, my God, Hamburg, Milan, London, it's huge over there. And so they absolutely love They love American football because we're playing there in November and we're already sold out against the Patriots in November. And they love rock and roll. And so we're going to take it to Europe. Eventually, it'll be, you know, I have three daughters. It'll be put in a trust and there'll be trustees, but it won't be able to be touched. It'll be curated and in a museum, you know, for after when I'm gone, you know, which I don't know when that'll be. I'm not planning on dying soon, but you have to make these plans. So, you know, eventually, you know, 30, 40, 50 years from now, it's going to be in a museum somewhere, but we don't know where. I'd like to have it in Indy, but it may need to be more like in New York or you know, somewhere like that, Los Angeles. You know, it's undecided where that would be, but way down the road. But we're going to keep taking it on the road because I tell you, it's just, look at, you know, I do, this is a give back to the fans for saying thank you for buying Colts Patriot tickets for, you know, $300 or more. Thank you, you know, the band members are saying, you know, thank you for buying, you know, tickets to Hart, to Billy Gibbons, to, you know, to the Eagles, the rock group with Vince Gill playing with us, et cetera. This is saying, you know, this one's for you. This is for the fans. This is a service to the arts and to the hardworking people. I don't need your money. You know, this is for you. This is to give you a free night out, you know, and yeah, have a blast and see one of the most incredible museums and bands in the world for free. And in Indy, I even bought the first beer and hot dog for everyone. So, you know, it's my way of saying thank you, you know, because look at, you know, I know what it's like to have to, you know, you have kids and you have a mortgage and you have a visa bill, and it's hard to pay, you know, the amount of some, like the Springsteen tickets possibly on his tour and that sort of thing, you know, and so we want to give back. I want to give back to the arts, and we always do massive charity things with this show too. So that's for real. People get confused because they don't understand. They go, well, I don't understand. There must be some catch. What do you mean it's for free? It's like, it's for free. You know, that's the real deal because, you know, for me, that's a way, you know, to give back, Eddie, to the arts. And so, you know, that's, I'm really passionate about that because more people that have worked hard and have been blessed with the ways and means, more billionaires, you know, they need to do more. I mean, they need to, you know, waitresses and construction workers and police officers and firemen, they don't make enough. They need to make more money, you know.
Radio show hosts, they don't either.
Well, that's right. Everyone, you know, we need, you know, not socialism, but we need to, anyone that wants to work hard should be paid and paid more in this country, exactly. You know, in my mind. So anyway, I'm not going to start rambling on that, but
no,
I will.
No, I got you. I appreciate where you're coming from on that. I really do.
Well, I'm passionate about it because, you know, we, you know, Boston's going to be really an exciting place. I hope people realize, you know, the opportunity that they have because, like you said, Eddie, people that have come and seen the show say, that's the greatest show I've ever seen in my life. And, I mean, I've seen shows since the 70s. I mean, you think, oh, there's just going to be a few guitars and I guess this band, they play a few songs.
No.
I mean, it's not that. I mean,
no,
you know.
It's all. I mean, no, I'm thrilled that I can say that I saw it. I mean, I came on the air, you know, having nothing to do with anything. I just, by the way, I walked in there that day that I went to Vegas completely like, you know, I wasn't set up. I wasn't on any list. I just went because I'm like, wow, I've heard about Jim collecting this stuff. I'm a huge rock fan. I want to see this. And I'm like, you literally just walk in and it's in a beautiful setting. And there was just like a great stage and you guys were playing. And then I met some of your people and then I was lucky enough to meet you and say hello and all that. But it was just, yeah, I can't recommend it more highly. I did to my audience right after I saw it. And I will again right now, July 15th.
And, you know, all the musicians look at it. We started this thing saying, look it, we're 17 years old, we're in a garage band, we're having fun. Don't even bother. Look at, this is for fun. If you're not having a blast and everyone in the band loves each other, we tip our hat to all these movers who make us look so good because they literally set up a first-class museum with their bare hands, with hard work and sweat, so people can see this stuff. And it's just remarkable. And believe me, it's a big pull. It takes a lot, semi-trucks, many, many planes. I mean, it's a big show to push, but it's great because you want to bring joy to the world. I mean, there's too much human suffering, too many times when people are under stress, and it gives people a chance for 3 hours in their life on a day to say, hey, I'm just going to go and chill and take this time for joy and for happiness and for enlightenment, for inspiration. And that's what it's about. And you get that feel in everyone that's there because everyone wants to be there and they love to be there. And the band, that's the feeling that the band has, the camaraderie.
Totally.
They all know it's in that spirit of love. And so, my job is just to produce the best show possible. And that's what I try to do. Like I said, give the people what they want. Have them going away feeling that they really, really had 3 hours of their life, that they were inspired and entertained, and it didn't cost them a penny. And that means a lot to me.
Yeah, there's no way you can beat that. Jim, last thing, I'll let you go on this. My audience would kill me if I didn't ask you this. Many of them called in and said, you got to ask them. There's a tremendous amount of frustration among rock fans, which I cater to, about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and how little rock they're actually putting in to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in recent years. And I've been trying to get going a true Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Would you ever have any interest in seeing something like that happen, getting involved in it, getting behind it, maybe even folding in your museum into something like that? Or are you okay with
the way I'm always open to looking at new frontiers because they're going to develop as we go forward in 2023 and beyond. And look at, I mean, how is Jethro Tull not in the Rock and Roll
Hall? There you go.
I mean, how
let's go, Jim.
Possibly,
let's build it. Build it. Let's go
true.
Do it.
You know, and so I think you're always looking at new synergies that can be really positive. And look, we're taking care of rock right now. That's also what this show is about, you know, is we don't have a lot of guys that are going to be around very much longer. You know, Buddy Guy plays with us at 88 years old, which is one of the most remarkable things when Buddy's with the band. He can't be for Boston, unfortunately, but, you know, he's been with us many times. And it's just incredible, you know, the stories, you know, that he tells. And he's the last standing guy. I mean, but he's the original. You know, it's like, you know, great musicians like Kenny Wayne Shepherd see him or Mike Mills or whatever from R.E.M. and they go, you know, that guy's the original. We try to, like, copy him. You know, we'll never be him.
I've interviewed him a couple times, man, and he's a wonderful
guy. Daddy.
It's been an honor to interview him. I've done a couple TV things with him, and he's just such a nice man as well.
Well, American treasure for sure, and a great guy. So I love to hear, you know, we're all trying to keep that light burning bright for rock and roll because we know how music has changed and everything else has changed. So, you know, I think that's so important because there's still a big appetite, even amongst the young people, that their moms and grandpas and grandmas and older brothers and sisters played for them, and they love to they love to hear these songs, you know. You know, when we're playing and Ann Wilson does Van Morrison's Into the Mystic, that's a magical moment now, and it's hard to, you can't find that almost anywhere. If anyone ever has a chance to see her version she did with our band, it's just unbelievable, you know. So let's keep that light burning, Eddie, no question about it. And I do want to add one thing. With the collection, the non-famous guitars are immense, you know, pre-World War II Martin D45s. You know, there's a Martin guitar from 1850, in a coffin case. There's just some of the greatest electric guitars in the world, Les Paul lineage, Strat lineages, that are carefully put into the collection. So true lovers of the guitar and those that, like, you know, Kenny Wayne Shepherd helps me a lot in acquiring, you know, not in bidding, but off and buying it separately in private sales, some of these really great guitars that were never owned by someone famous per se. But that's incredible to see, too, because there are the people that really do know what it means to have a 1959 Les Paul in mint condition, you know. So those are in the collection, too, for true guitar lovers and guitar players, because there's a lot of those out there, too.
Yeah, no doubt. It's great stuff. I really appreciate the time, Jim. It's great to talk to you. It was great to meet you briefly in Vegas, and I look forward to hopefully seeing you again, and I think it's wonderful what you're doing. It's fantastic that you've made this free for people. It's a celebration. It's just such a great afternoon, and I encourage everybody, if you're in the Boston area, to go see it at TD Garden this coming Saturday, starting at 6 p.m. Great to talk to you, and
Thanks so much, man. I hope to see you soon. And, you know, I really appreciate the time. Love your show. And, you know, we're fired up for Saturday night in Boston. So everyone come on out. And all you do is have to register for your free ticket. And you get it, and you're in, and that's that. So really looking forward to a great night. And thanks so much for having me, Eddie.
You got it. Hope to see you soon, Jim. Thank you very much for the time.
All right, bro. Thank you. Bye-bye.
See ya. Take care. Well, it'd be nice if Jim Irsay lets us build a real Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, right? I had to ask. It was great to talk to him, and I hope the event went well in Boston. Of course, the stuff we were talking about in there, that particular event has already happened. But if he does one of those showings near you, I highly recommend it because it's really, really cool. And I thank him for taking some time out and joining us here on the Eddie Trunk podcast, and of course originally on Trunk Nation, which is where all the interviews you hear originated. And again, if you'd like to come on board and join me on SiriusXM, you live in the US or Canada, you're not already listening every day 3 to 5 Eastern time live on Faction Talk 103 or on the app, you can try it for free. SiriusXM.com/Eddie Trunk, no credit card required. Get your free 3-month trial and listen every day to Trunk Nation on 103, again, 3 to 5 Eastern time, live or on demand, whenever you'd like. Be sure to follow on social media at Eddie Trunk, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook page. Check out the new YouTube show, That Rocks, on YouTube, totally free. Punch it in. I've got my old Bat Metal Show partners back, Don Jameson and Jim Florentine. We do a show free every week on YouTube. Some of the great names in rock joining us each and every week as well. Check it out. There's about a dozen episodes there for you to check out right now. Again, just go to YouTube, punch in That Rocks. You'll see them all come up. And you can subscribe there as well so you never miss any information as to when we're going to be doing the show live, because we do that live initially on YouTube as well. All right, so a lot going on. Hope you guys are all enjoying your summer. Hope you enjoyed the interviews. And I'll catch you next Thursday for another podcast. Take care.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.